My name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm a vice president of the Chapter 92 Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg chapter. And with me today are Nikki and Daniel of Resist U.S.-Led Wars in Seattle. And they're going to talk about activities that's happened here in Seattle, and particularly University of Washington and downtown, and also of which United States Veterans for Peace is also participating in the downtown demonstrations. So go ahead, Nikki or Daniel, whoever wants to start off with this story of what's happening at the University of Washington in particular.
I can introduce myself and pass it out to Daniel to go more in depth. Hello, Nikhil or Nick or Nikki with Resist US-Led War Seattle. Excited to be on the show today to talk about the moment that we're in and the organizing that Resist has been doing at UW. Specifically, Resist is waging a campaign calling on UW to cut ties with Boeing, the third largest weapons corporation in the world. We've seen massive public outrage at the ongoing genocide of Palestine carried out by the U.S. and Zionist state of Israel, fueled by profit, fueled by weapons contracts. I think $60 billion in aid, total aid to Ukraine and Israel and elsewhere was just passed this past week. So we're seeing, despite the massive public outrage, the continual funnel of our taxpayer dollars into weapons contracts, into Boeing's bottom line, into Lockheed's bottom line, fueling the genocide, fueling the war. So we're protesting Boeing, weapons companies, U.S.-led war and imperialism. Pass it to Daniel.
Okay, thank you, Nikki. Go ahead, Daniel.
You add? Thanks. Yeah, of course. My name is Daniel, also with Resist US-Led War Seattle. I've been organizing for almost 2 years now with Resist, coming up on 2 years this summer. I think to give a little background on our particular campaign at the University of Washington, in which we call on UW to cut ties with Boeing, we really wanted to understand, right, when we hear about all of these catastrophic events around the world, the U.S. backing of genocide, and even, you know, like U.S. wars of aggression that are taking place every single day, kind of in various parts around the globe. We wanted to understand, how are we involved locally? What is our direct contribution to these atrocities? What are the local manifestations of the war machine? Within Seattle, right, Boeing is a massive institution. They've been here for decades. There's a large part of the economy that is built on Boeing employment at the factories up in Everett and down in Renton. We also know that Boeing invests a lot into the University of Washington. UW is a key part of the pipeline that Boeing is trying to create, in which it funnels students into working for them. Of course, they want to employ particularly talented youth. You know, they want to be recruiting kind of the brightest minds into their operations, right? Because Boeing's a business, they got to compete against other transnational weapons companies. They have to compete for these massive, extremely lucrative government contracts. And for that, they need, you know, real smart minds, a lot of talent and labor to be poured into engineering all different kinds of machines and weapons. And so the University of Washington, our perspective is we see it as a key point within that pipeline, that Boeing is consciously investing into in order to secure that stream of labor. And of course, like, whitewash their reputation, right? Launder the image that they have. A lot of folks that we talk to have a pretty rosy picture of Boeing locally. You know, for many people, it's been, you know, the source of income for a family for many decades, if not generations, right? So a lot of folks feel that they owe their lives, or, you know, a large portion of their lives to Boeing. But of course, you know, we're hearing more and more the ways in which the workplace at a lot of these factories has not been, the labor conditions have been pretty brutal. Boeing has laid off, you know, thousands of employees over the past couple of years. And then within the university, of course, despite plenty of investment into engineering fields, in particular computer science, they're, you know, Boeing is kind of plastering its name on a lot of buildings and programs. And, you know, really, like, I think some folks perceive it as Boeing supporting our education system, Boeing providing an opportunity for folks to go to school, right, that might not otherwise have to. But we're asking the questions, why does a weapons company have to fund our public education system? Why do we need corporations like Boeing to invest into our schools in order for people to get decent paying jobs and a livelihood that can sustain themselves, right? So we're really interested in connecting with the community at the University of Washington and in Greater Seattle to uncover some of these darker truths behind Boeing, to really show and expose the role that Boeing plays within these wars around the world, and that Boeing actually doesn't have our community's best interests at heart. It's the people, you know, that really should be in control of their own education system, right? Not corporations like Boeing. So yeah, we're reaching students, we're reaching community members, faculty, and growing up the anti-war movement with the particular lens and angle of exposing and opposing these transnational weapons companies like Boeing.
Thank you, Daniel. You know, one of the things I think that the many people here in this area and probably other parts of the country don't realize is how major a producer Boeing is of weapons. As I understand, their drones, missiles, and other weapon systems. And I don't know exactly how much of that their corporate business is that, but I know it's very, very large. But it's also something that people here don't really realize what a major player Boeing is in weapons productions. You got any idea of how large a component that is of Boeing's production and their?
Yeah. I mean, it varies year to year, right? They have these particular sectors within Boeing. One is for commercial purposes. One is their defense sector. And then they have a services sector, right? That includes like the training to use the equipment and things like that. And so typically, yeah, folks kind of might see the commercial side as separated from the military side. And that's how they break down their revenue as well, right? They show which of these sectors are drawing in a certain amount of money. Typically, on average, year to year, about half of the that Boeing makes, the revenue that they generate, derives directly from their military sector. So it is a very large portion. But we also have the analysis that as a company overall, we should still be seeing them as a weapons company, not a company with many different segments, but the commercial side and the military side, they feed into each other, right? A lot of the technology they develop within one supports the technology that they're developing within the other sector, right? And so by using both of these portions, Boeing is able to, you know, during war booms, able to really ramp up their military production during, like downtimes for commercial air orders, they're able to offset some of that production costs with the military production specifically. And so both of these portions and really the military equipment that they're producing is what is also keeping the company afloat, right? So, you know, even though it's roughly half year to year, we still want to be seeing Boeing overall as a weapons company.
And as I understand it, the weapons productions of Boeing, that's an international business. It's not just supplying the U.S. military market.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the U.S. military is the largest customer of Boeing, the U.S. government is. But of course, you know, the U.S. government is able to authorize, right, like lethal aid packages, military aid to other countries, which then end up purchasing Boeing equipment, right? So we see a lot of the local, even production of like the Poseidon P-8, a military surveillance plane, is sent all over the world to countries like Norway, that are placing these kinds of orders.
It's one of two ways, right? There's the foreign military financing that you mentioned, the military aid, like the $60 billion package we just saw, and then also Boeing contracts directly with fascist and repressive governments around the world. Like, for example, with Israel, right? In our backyard and up in Everett, KC-46A Pegasus tanker refueling jet is being produced, and that is one of Israel's most like prized contracts with American weapons companies. They're interested in these large tanker refueling jets so that they can extend long range attacks over the course of the entire Asian continent, over all of the Middle East. We saw them being used in direct strikes against Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. We know that like Boeing has lots of subsidiary weapons corporations, like for example, in C2, the drone company that operates out of White Salmon down by the Columbia River, in which they produce drones, surveillance drones that are being sold directly to the armed forces of the Philippines, being used to terrorize and surveil land defenders by the fascist government. So in many ways, it's an international business, but we know that the U.S., it's in service of U.S. Foreign policy, in service of U.S. aggression, whether it's in Palestine or it's in the Philippines or it's elsewhere.
Right, because even if it's not within a formal military aid package that the U.S. is drafting as like legislation, the U.S. still has to approve of the sales of arms equipment to other countries. So even if you know, Israel reaches out to Boeing, they say we want to buy these planes, Boeing has to get U.S. government approval to make these sales.
By U.S. government, like this is something that Veterans for Peace has been protesting, that Resist has been protesting. We see just how democratic these military budgets are, how much of a say we really have in the National Defense Authorization Act and these approved arms sales. I think more and more we're seeing really who gets to make the decision. It's a few important senators, congressmen, and an army of lobbyists at the weapons company's disposal who descend on Washington to write these bills, to design the policy in order to maximize profits for them. So
and
we don't have a say.
And these two U.S. senators from Washington, Patty Murray and what's your name? They have been longtime supporters of the weapons industry, in particular Boeing, haven't they?
Maria Cantwell.
Yeah, Maria Cantwell. Yeah, they've supported, well, not only that, but also overseas wars of aggression. And Maria Cantwell, we had a meeting with her some years ago. She never recanted her support of the Iraq invasion, for example. But anyway, those two people are fairly powerful U.S. senators and are very, very involved in weapons appropriation and funding, is my understanding.
Yeah, and a really prime example would be the minority chair of the House Armed Services Committee, that being Adam Smith. local representative for Washington's 9th. His office is down in Renton. Been there a few times to protest it. But if you look at his, if you look at the people who spend money on his campaign over the last 20 years, four out of five of the top donors to Adam Smith are weapons corporations, like straight up weapons corporations, Lockheed and Boeing and Raytheon and others. And I think the fifth one is Microsoft.
You're talking about big corporations. Yeah, lots of money there. Huge amounts of money. How effective do you think it's been to, say, approach the legislative side of the support? People are supporting the weapons production, that sort of thing, like Cantwell, Murray, Adam Smith. They've been around for a long time, all of them. And do you think that any of your activities or other people's activities protesting this have any sort of effect on them? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we don't want to neglect that avenue, right? Of making change. We see our work as a grassroots organization as really being able to find what are all the different channels that we're able to use to activate people into taking action, right? So I think in wanting to show the complicity and really like the role of the U.S. government and our local representatives of the U.S. government, what is their role within the war machine? I think it's important to be directly confronting asking hard questions, but also showing the people power that we have on our side that is opposing the decisions that they're making in the legislature. Of course, even if we were to meet with them, have conversations, I believe Nikhil is planning to have a conversation soon with some local representatives. But these are options that we should be still employing as activists and as organizers to hear, what do our legislators have to say for themselves? How can they possibly justify this massive military budget? But on the other hand, we know that they don't fundamentally represent our interests, right? And so it's up to us to build up that power. One, to pressure the politicians into understanding that we have the people on our side. We should be able to, be able to elect somebody else if we're not pleased with their choices. Of course, they have a lot of money on their side, right? But we want to be able to show that, but then also understand that like some of our channels are not going to be directly through passing legislation or pressuring our senators, right? That ultimately the grassroots power is really what's needed to help build up those alternatives. I don't know if you have anything to add, Nikhil.
Let me just say that I think that this is probably critical in just activism generally, and the old standard, the old saw is write a letter to your legislature and then don't do anything but peaceful protest. No disruptions of traffic, that sort of thing. There was recently a disruption here on I-5, which people were sort of, some people were outraged, that sort of thing. But the point is, that's the whole point of the thing, is to disrupt society and get some publicity and start talking about the issues. I think a lot of people do respect that sort of point of view. But again, it's like, the Seattle Times in particular with the Blethins, and I heard this too when I was protesting and others during the Vietnam War. Says, well, why can't you just be, white collar and quiet and write letters to your senators and that sort of thing? Well, that doesn't work. Protests do, and direct action does work, and I think you guys are doing a great job. Can you talk about now what's you're involved in the University of Washington and what's happening? What sort of a response have you got from the university to some of the activities you've been involved in there?
I can start off if you want to fill in the gaps, Nikhil. But we've been trying to identify over the past 2 years or so. What are all the different areas in which we can find Boeing's presence? There are tentacles kind of reaching into all different kinds of programs, departments, buildings, internships, things like that. So we're uncovering a lot of those pieces. And you know, it's really hard to keep up sometimes. You know, there's a speaker from either Boeing or the US military or some foreign policy think tank that is, you know, at the behest of Boeing and the US military. Speakers like that are coming to the campus almost weekly on a weekly basis. Because yeah, they are offered a platform by the university to spread their lies. And so a lot of what Resist has been doing is trying to identify those moments to really counter what's happening in those speeches or in those events. There was a climate solution summit, for instance, last year that was hosted by Boeing was one of the sponsors of the event. And yeah, the focus is really in these types of things, like how can we, this is what the university wants to frame it as. What is the technology that's needed to improve our world? What are the, how can we make aviation fuel more sustainable to make Boeing's operations better for the planet, right? This is how these problems are framed. And we see things a little bit differently, right? A lot of people don't know that the US military is the number one institutional polluter of greenhouse gases, right, on the entire planet. And Boeing plays a massive role in that. So we know that it's not really up to the specific fuel that Boeing is using. It's about the role that the US military plays in trying to control basically the planet, right? That is not very environmentally sustainable. And so any real climate solution summit needs to include that analysis, right? How are we tackling the problem of the US military itself as one of the most destructive forces on the entire planet, both to people and the environment? So we're finding a lot of those opportunities to, you know, either show up, create, yeah, protest, direct action, but we also really want to be talking to people. We want to be out there flyering to share our analysis, to hear what other people think, to help guide our campaign. And so we've been regularly on the campus, tabling, talking to people, finding different spots and communities to be engaging in order to organize people, you know, to stand up against the university administration and against the US war machine and embolden them and empower them to do so. So right now, what we're planning, we're looking ahead for the next couple of weeks to build up against the Board of Regents at the University of Washington, where we're going to be hosting an action along with many other organizations that have their own grievances with the university, right? The university admin is not just complicit in funneling people into the war machine. They are also complicit in raising the price of education to completely unsustainable levels for a public education system. They are complicit in the lack of affordable housing that is available to students and graduate students and faculty, right? There are many different issues that affect people across the University of Washington campus. And the broader community that we're trying to bring together in a show of force in the early May to confront the Board of Regents, to share our demands, and to, yeah, really enable people to stand up to the university admin. Are there other kind of like more history or other events and things that you want to share, Nikhil, about our campaign so far?
Oh yeah, I mean, say, there's plenty to dig into, right? We have been waging this campaign for a year and a half now. And when we started, Boeing had free rein to be this progressive force, you know, to brand them friendly, to have all of these events and whatnot, for the university to celebrate it and talk about how innovative their engineering department is because of Boeing's partnership. And now here we are, a year and a half later, and UW cannot hide. Boeing cannot hide from its true nature. The university president, Annemarie Kalsay, said in a letter to organized protesters for the UW United Front for Palestinian Liberation, that UW is proud to have Boeing and proud that Boeing is a is in defense, you know, is a weapons company. Basically, just very candidly admitting that this is an important partnership with the university, and this partnership that they know and that they care for the weapons aspect. And so it's only because of one, because of a massive email campaign on the part of students to force the president to respond, and also because of the escalation on December 12th, within which several students sat in on the president's office to really force UW to respond to their demands to cut ties with Israel and cut ties with Boeing, that have forced this to happen. And it's also because of the massive public education that we've done on the campus throughout the past year, holding teach-ins and flyering, tabling every day, hearing about the conditions, filing FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, to really understand the nature of the pipeline. So it's through dedicated research, consistent education, and direct action that we've been able to force the university to really admit its partnership, expose the systemic nature of it, the privatization of the university, and its continual ties to Boeing and weapons companies. And now the next step is to continue putting that pressure, to use their words against them, to continue escalating and pushing for demands that we know can be met. We know that the university has the ability and to change its relationship to companies. We've seen this at other universities. We've seen this historically. And so really the power is in the people, the power is in us, in students, in workers at the university to press their demands and press our demands. I think with this upcoming Board of Regents mobilization that Daniel's mentioning, and this really ties into your last question also, of really seeing the connectedness of things, seeing the different avenues with which we can put pressure and bring people in. We see that, you know, for climate groups, it's a climate is an anti-war issue. For labor, for unions, they care about where their technology and where their resources are put towards. Anti-war and labor are deeply connected. For many different groups, there's an intersection with the anti-war movement that's coming more and more to the forefront, and a real opportunity to cut ties with war profiteers at UW and other institutions.
Well, it seems from what you said that there is actually a good positive response from students and perhaps also staff there at the university to your points that you raise in reference to Boeing and the university. So you've had very good response from students to your flyering and tabling and calls for action. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, not everyone's going to be on the same page, but that's part of our work, is to, we want to hear where folks are at and try to connect our analysis to the issues that other folks are experiencing, right? Whether they see them as connected to Boeing or not, right? Ultimately, the role of Boeing at the University of Washington and UW as a one component in the broader military industrial complex is a symptom of the economic system that we exist under, right? It's the same reason why that there's massive need for, there are so many people visiting the UW food pantry every single week, right? And that's the same reason that folks are being forced into the weapons industry, is because one, our university and our public education system do not serve the people. They don't serve our interests of our society. They're not built to tackle the root issues. And two, right, the economic system overall is forcing people into more and more dire conditions, right? And many folks are fleeing into what seem like safe industries like Boeing in order to make a living. So even for folks that don't see their issues as connected to an issue as large as war, we've been able to have many great conversations with folks to try to see how we're all connected. And I think like one of the results, like one of the ways that we measure our success has been in the growth of our organization. We have tripled in size since we've grown, since we launched, or maybe quadrupled, I believe. And, you know, our mobilizations have been very successful, whether they were the student walkout at the University of Washington back in October, in which hundreds of students poured into Red Square to stand up to the university administration to deliver the demands that Resist and many other organizations have been putting forward to cut ties. And even off campus, right? We've been able to connect with so many other organizations and groups to expose Boeing's role in Seattle. I know that VFP, Daniel Ellsberg chapter was there for the Boeing Defense Supplier Summit, March 12th, I believe, and with hundreds of others on a weekday morning afternoon to tell Boeing to get the hell out of our city, to get the hell out of our convention center, and take their weapons subsidiaries with them. So yeah, the response I think largely has been very positive, and it's just the beginning too. You know, we're a relatively new organization. Of course, many folks have been working on building out the anti-war movement for many decades, such as yourself, and we have really learned a lot through working with y'all to continue to fight and grow our movement to reach more and more people.
Well, excuse me, the success of the anti-war movement in particular, and anti-corporate weapons in particular, is exemplified by Boeing and University of Washington, is your younger participation in this is very critical in this movement generally. And or older organizations, actually Veterans for Peace is kind of an old organization, not just in how long it's been around, but many of us are I'm 79, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and it's very heartening to see younger faces and younger activists like yourself, particularly very, very well informed, and you're specific to your points that you make with backed up with facts and that sort of thing. It's not just a protest. That's extremely important to have that, and you're very knowledgeable, and that's to be commended for that sort of thing. I think that resonates with a lot of people. And for example, it says they don't realize how deeply involved Boeing is in weapons. Is that some sort of reaction that you come across with people at large, or particularly students, that they don't realize how deeply involved Boeing and University of Washington by complicity in these programs? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. People don't know, right? Because Boeing and our legislators don't want people to know. They want part of the task of that the UW is commissioned with at the University of Washington by Boeing and by these corporations that invest is to really brandish their reputation to paint them as these progressive forces and it's the effect of that propaganda and that those efforts is really deep set. It's many decades of you know, not just with weapons corporations, but just the seeing the US military as this like positive force in the world. The things that we grew up with, the things that we're exposed to, you know, the ways in which we're told that the US military protects democracy around the world. It doesn't take much to actually pull that facade apart, just basic education and also people's own personal experiences. It resonates with the analysis because it's true, right? For those who grew up around military bases and have experienced like environmental degradation or who have been forced into the military at a very young age without really knowing what they're serving or where they would be going, people's own lives and experiences are backed up when we talk about the U.S. military, and we talk about weapons corporations. It just takes being out there in the streets and talking to people to really dig into the truth.
Can you add anything to that, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think when we are out there talking to people, one of my favorite sort of like hooks to just start off talking to somebody is like just the question, did you know Boeing is a weapons company? And a lot of people say no, right? Or the people, or many people do. And like Nikhil was saying, like, they don't see anything wrong with that, right? They don't see anything wrong with the US economy being propped up almost entirely on war, right? They don't see that as a problem. But, you know, through discussion and like a lot of the political education events that we've been hosting, I think it's, yeah, and folks is like, own knowledge of their own conditions and histories. Like, I think it's becoming more and more clear as conditions worsen around the U.S. While our, you know, our senators and representatives keep pouring money into Ukraine and Israel, that yeah, that something's wrong, right? Something is not right about how our economy and our political system is working. It does not feed people's needs, right? So increasingly, those tensions are becoming heightened, and that's where we can kind of dig in and really expose and try to activate folks in a direction toward, yeah, against the U.S. military.
Well, I would seem that the point being made that the bombs being dropped in Israel, when they're using mostly bombs and missiles, and also aircraft, much of that is made by the United States, in particular Boeing. It's, you know, we're funding the war. It's not just an abstract sort of thing that we're funding the Israeli, but these are American-made munitions and aircraft that are killing all these people. I've, you know, I saw quite a bit of damage in Vietnam from American bombs and sort of stuff, including some collateral damage. But I'm amazed that there isn't more mainstream press, although that's probably understandable considering how connected they are to the war, that there's the actual horror of 35,000 people, probably thousands more buried underneath the rubble. That's not a bigger issue than it is. And I can't think of anything short of Vietnam that this many civilians have been killed certainly in this kind of shorter time. We're talking about a few months. You know, in the mainstream news industry is, and according by, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, even the Guardian, are, you know, complicit in sort of minimizing the actual horror of that war. And I'm sure that that's something that you guys address in your protests.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. learned a lot of lessons, right, from Vietnam, which is that the U.S. And the war machine need tighter control over the narrative and over
absolutely.
how things are being broadcast.
That's the only thing that the United States military learned from Vietnam is that you have to control the narrative. Don't let anybody on the battlefield. Don't let anybody talk. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, because we saw what happened when they didn't, right? When the truth was coming out about what was happening in Vietnam, people rose up, right? There was a massive movement to end the war in Vietnam, the U.S. war of aggression there, right? And so ever since then, especially, there have been all kinds of ways that the U.S. Is able to, like, what do they call it? It's called like manufacturing consent, right? But just drum up support for the war and tightly control the narrative, right? A lot of the corporate media have very restrictive editing policies to ensure that specific narratives are pushed, right? That even something as small as like the language that's being used, right? When Palestinians are killed by Israel, it's often described in a passive voice, right? Or without naming the perpetrator. But then when it's the other way around, of course, it's described in a very active voice, right? So there are all kinds of little tricks that are being used to really, drive kind of a narrative within like the popular culture and understanding of the US. Two, you know, be outraged when Russia attacks Ukraine, right? All of a sudden, people you never knew even knew about Ukraine were diehard patriotic fans of Ukraine because of so much work that has been put into demonizing Russia and seeing Russia as like one of the main enemies of the US, which the corporate media has had a lot of a big role within, right? And then similarly, with the ongoing occupation and genocide of Palestine, there have been so many, like falsehoods peddled throughout the media or truths left out. Even when reporting on casualties, right? It's so often the horror is obscured just through numbers, right? It doesn't mean anything anymore to people. It's leaving out the stories of the people on the ground in Gaza that are experiencing this horror every day. I think that's a real big need for organizations and alternative media and programs exactly like this, right? Radio channels to get out and challenge the dominant narrative that's being pushed, especially through corporate media and institutions like, you know, the government and White House.
Yeah, well, in the case of Israel, Gaza, the evidence for what's happening there is very, very plain. I think that the narrative for Russia and Ukraine is a little bit more complicated. It's very clear that the Russians have acted in a very thuggish and brutal way towards civilian casualties in particular. Not that the Ukrainians haven't done some of that themselves, but they are... it's difficult, I would imagine, to get the point that the Russians are the good guys in this, because they're not. Putin is a is a long time cop, ex-cop, KGB guy, and the people are supporting it. It's unfortunate that it's Russian soldiers are having to pay the price of his aggression.
Right. Yeah, and I think like it's not to say that Russia is the good guy necessarily, right? But it's more about how is the media, how's the narrative framed, right? And where is US like popular culture, what is it activated towards, right? All of a sudden Ukrainian flags were everywhere to be found, right? But then when Israel begins and launches its genocide, right, are those same people hoisting the Palestinian flag? Most of the time they are not, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
On this note, I think it's also like a dehistoricizing, right? Like all of a sudden at the start of 2022, like you're hearing about Ukraine and Russia, but we're not hearing about NATO buildup in Eastern Europe. We're not hearing about US like economic and military policy like that is threatening Russia and threatening the region and throwing them into a state in which Russia is, as you know, a bad actor, but is emboldened to respond violently, you know, due to U.S. Aggression in the region. So it's the idea that the narrative starts now and the U.S. is going to start the history mark right now. And I think this is one of the big reasons that Resist U.S.-led War is taking up a campaign to cancel RIMPAC. I don't know if you've heard much or have been following the upcoming maritime, the maritime exercises happening in Hawaii in June and July or in July. But we're seeing a similar thing where the US is like building up in Asia Pacific. It's massively increasing its amount of military presence in Taiwan and the Philippines and Okinawa and Japan and Korea, Australia, Guam and Hawaii, where these maritime exercises will take place this coming July. And we're seeing it go by without any sort of notice really from the mainstream media. There's no real notice of how blatantly and aggressively the US is arming to the teeth the entire Asia Pacific and directing all of their missiles towards China. What we are seeing is this big campaign that is describing China as the greatest threat to democracy in the world today. You know, there's this all this every Time magazine cover and every editorial in the Washington Post is talking about the great war that's coming between the US and China, and how the US has to be passing these bloated military budgets in order to counteract it. And so what we as resist want to be doing is to be identifying that the conflict is happening right now. The war is happening right now. The US does not get to dictate when the narrative starts. We see that the Rim of the Pacific exercises, which are a massive act of aggression against the indigenous people that live there, the native Hawaiians who suffer the consequences of boats being blown up off their coasts, of live firing exercises being conducted at the foot of Mauna Kea and their sacred mountain. We see the massive influx of military personnel leading to increased violence against women. We see the effects of U.S. occupation and military and war games happening in real time in Hawaii and in the Philippines and in Okinawa, where the U.S. is amping up its military presence and escalating so that they can make money, so they can profit off of the upcoming war. And so as Resist U.S.-led War, we're calling to cancel the Rim of the Pacific Maritime Exercises, to cancel RIMPACT, to oppose war games, U.S.-led military alliances, and the U.S. buildup in Asia Pacific that have massive costs to the people of the region and are leading us closer and closer to World War III. Really.
Yeah, well, you know, the hype, particularly about against China. China is the largest trading partner with the United States. The idea that the Chinese and the Americans are actually going to get involved in a shooting war is fairly remote, although the militarists keep hyping that as something that's, as a danger. I don't think it's really a danger for a shooting war, maybe some dust up about Taiwan, but the Chinese are not stupid. They're not going to get into a war with the United States, which they probably wouldn't mean. They're not going to. Chinese are known for being fairly smart, actually, when it comes down to this sort of thing. And the idea that they're going to bail up on a trillions and trillion dollar trading partner with the United States is ridiculous. And how dangerous they are really is not. It's, you know, historically, the Chinese, we're not a maritime power, and they're barely one now. They've mostly been concerned with the Chinese looking inwardly. They're kind of they've got sort of a racist sort of identification with Chinese and Han being, you know, the great people of Asia, and some of that's true. But I mean, the idea that they're a military threat to the United States is absurd. For the reasons that I've just given, one of the reasons anyway, the trading. But I mean, you're very, very clear and correct too about, you know, this build military buildup. And it's not just in the Pacific, but it's also world. I mean, we've got, what, 8 or 7 fleets worldwide. We've got 2 or 3 aircraft in the Persian Gulf at the moment, you know, which are shooting up Houthi mortar sites. The idea that you can solve anything by shooting a war is ridiculous. You know, we spent 20 years in Afghanistan recently, and what was that all about? No, there's no going. Where's the discussion of that? Or for that matter, going back to a little earlier, you know, to the invasion of Iraq and how fucked up that invasion is, fucked up the Middle East. Not that there wasn't some problems there to start with, but that made things a lot worse. Something like Al Qaeda wasn't in Iraq before the United States got there, but they showed up pretty quickly, and we're seeing the residue of that with ISIS and other organizations. The other point I'd like to make, and it's true of not only the Middle East but the rest of the world, is that much of this opposition to the United States and other Western imperialism is based on anti-colonial attitudes. And religion plays an important part, especially if you're talking about Islam, but it's not necessarily an Islamic thing or a jihadist thing or anything like that. It's the natural reaction of these countries and these populations against imperialism. They use the word in the Middle East. They still use the word crusader, and it's still a fairly inaccurate description of the interventions by Western forces into the Middle East, you know.
Absolutely, and I think we're gonna continue to see the resistance movements growing in strength as the U.S. is extending itself across the world, really overextending itself. It can't continue to maintain its foothold in all of the different locations it has. It's trying really hard, especially through the military alliances and deals that it's brokering, to extend its influence to allow, you know, partners or puppet states to be enacting the violence on behalf of the US. It's trying to maintain its foothold, but it's not going to be able to. And so we're seeing the cracks, right? We're seeing resistance movements like in Palestine, like in Yemen, rising up and actually challenging the US war machine. And I think that's, you know, that's where Resist US-led War, we stand in solidarity with these resistance movements, with these anti-colonial, anti-imperialist struggles, particularly struggles of national liberation, right? For people to determine their own sovereignty, and how to govern their lives and their countries, that the US is vehemently opposed to. So as kind of the US military budget continues to rise, as it's trying to oversee all of these different portions, it's trying to understand how can we possibly give China the importance that we want to give it, right? How can we invest in building up in the Asia Pacific while we still have to tend to the Middle East, while we have to kind of support Ukraine? We're going to continue to see resistance movements and these struggles and upsurges grow and strengthen, and ultimately challenge and kick out U.S. imperialism from these areas, and that is going to be a real threat to the U.S. war machine. And so you know, while we at the University of Washington are struggling against our local manifestations of the war machine, and the way that the school contributes to the strength of the U.S. military, we know that our struggle is deeply connected with and you know, has the same overall goals as many of these struggles around the world that are struggling in various forms, right? They are building out the mass movement in the cities. They are arming the peasants and forming communities in the countryside to grow out the revolutionary movement there. And so Resist US-led War Seattle and our global alliance, we stand in solidarity with these movements because we know that they are real threats to the US war machine and allies within this struggle.
Well, great. I mean, our time is just about gone, but thank you, Nikki, Ed, and Daniel, for this excellent program and for your detailed exposition of what you're doing in particularly the United States and its war effort. This is Mike Diedrich for Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92, and this program will be broadcast on KODX 96.9. It will also be archived there and also at the VFP92.org website. It hopefully will be posted tomorrow, but I'll see if Mike McCormick can make that happen. So anyway, thanks again, and we'll probably have to do another program. It seems like there's much more information, and I'd be glad to do that with you. So ending it for now.
Thanks so much, Mike, for having us. Let's do this again.
Yes,